Hello and welcome to Background Briefing, available 24/7 at backgroundbriefing.org. I'm Ian Masters, and today we'll look into a number of stories and issues in the news. We'll begin with the Kavanaugh effect reflected in Trump's recent rhetoric that expands on male victimhood, which he used successfully in the 2016 campaign to convince the white working class they are being marginalized by minorities who are taking away their jobs and feminists who are taking away their manhood. Now, with Senator McConnell dismissing female protesters as a mob, Republicans are embracing the victimhood of a privileged white male to expand their base of beleaguered and oppressed men to make the case that not only has Kavanaugh been wronged, but his unfair treatment by the Democrats and the media shows that any man can be victimized in the era of the Me Too movement. Robert Jensen, a professor in the School of Journalism at the University of Texas, Austin, whose work has focused on the radical feminist critique of sexuality and men's violence, as well as questions of race through a critique of white privilege and institutionalized racism, joins us. We'll discuss President Trump's remarks following his victory celebration after seating Kavanaugh on the Supreme Court, which suggests the contentious confirmation has now become a trial over masculinity and embattled manhood. In response to a reporter's question about what would he say to young men in America, Trump replied, quote, "Well, I'd say that it's a scary time for young men in America when you could be guilty of something you may not be guilty of." Then we'll examine the elections today underway in Brazil, in which the leading Trump-like presidential candidate, Jair Bolsonaro, is even more open and extreme in expressing his authoritarian tendencies, saying an opposition female candidate is not worth raping and that he would prefer a dead son to a gay son. Joining us for an update on whether Bolsonaro will get the 50% of the vote to avoid a runoff is Maria Luisa Mendoza, the director of Brazil's Network for Social Justice and Human Rights, who is also a professor in the International Relations Department at the University of Rio de Janeiro. We'll assess the fate of Brazil's fragile democracy and whether the country will return to right-wing dictatorship. Then finally, with a month to go before the critical midterm elections, we will analyze the state of voting in the country following the record low turnout in the last 2014 midterms, in which only 140 million Americans voted, the lowest turnout since 1942, followed by just over 25% of American adults voting Donald Trump into the presidency in 2016. Alan Lichtman, a political historian at American University who has studied both the American right and the presidency, joins us to discuss his new book just out, The Embattled Vote in America, From the Founding to the Present. And joining us now, Robert Jensen, a professor in the School of Journalism at the University of Texas at Austin and a board member of the Third Coast Activist Resource Center in Austin. He is the author of Plain Radical, Living, Loving, and Learning to Leave the Planet Gracefully, Arguing for Our Lives, A User's Guide to Constructive Dialogue. And his latest book is The End of Patriarchy, Radical Feminism for Men. Welcome to Background Briefing, Robert Jensen.
Great to be with you, Ian.
Well, it would seem to me that the patriarchy, rather than ending, has gotten a whole new lease on life, with particularly in terms of the future of the judiciary in this country, which will shape our lives profoundly, where you have a patriarchal new judge making a 5-4 majority, perhaps for decades to come, joining another group of patriarchal white men, all of whom have been selected by the Federalist Society, and all of whom are extremely conservative. I don't know. Well, I hope you're right to suggest that there's an end of patriarchy, but at this point, it seems to be getting a revival.
Absolutely. The title of that book, The End of the Patriarchy, I always say was aspirational, not descriptive. That is to say, I'm not suggesting we're there. It's something to remind ourselves to go after. And part of the reason for the title of the book, and I think the important way you phrase this, is even within feminism, you often these days don't hear so much about patriarchy, that is, a system of institutionalized male dominance. And we have to remember it is a social system. Historically, the roots of patriarchy are really in men's claim to control women's reproductive power and women's sexuality. And as you pointed out, we're still fighting both of those battles. Of course, a lot of people's fear about a 5-4 right-wing majority on the court means the end of the rather fragile protection for reproductive rights, especially the right to an abortion. In other words, the assertion again of control over women's sexual or women's reproductive power. And then, of course, the battle to really give women control of their own sexuality we've been fighting for a long time, and not only aren't making so much progress on, but you could say in some ways we've lost ground on. True, there have been advances in, for instance, the way rape laws are written, but in practice it hasn't meant as much. The exploitation of women's sexuality, especially in what I call the sexual exploitation industries, pornography, prostitution, that sort of thing has gone on. And now we're seeing that even the core question of women's right to a kind of bodily integrity against male sexual violence is no longer as secure as we want. Your point that now Trump is using this to kind of turn the tables and suggest it is men who are at risk is really, one could say it's bizarre, but in a sense it's not. It's just Trump doing what Trump does well, which is invert reality when necessary to shore up his base.
So how do you feel about the fact that it was a woman who got Kavanaugh over the top, Senator Collins? She pretended to be – she's always pretended to be a moderate and also sympathetic to women's rights and in favor of a woman's right to choose. But she effectively – and I'm sure it was in collusion with Mitch McConnell – delivered the closing argument to seal the deal. So what is she, some kind of a traitor?
Well, you know, as a man, I make a point of not telling any women what they should believe or how they should act. But we should remember that a feminist critique, especially a radical feminist critique of patriarchy, never suggested that all women are good and all men are bad. If we go back to the earlier battles around this, let's say the Equal Rights Amendment, for instance, in the 1970s. Remember, it was Phyllis Schlafly, a woman who had used her organizing abilities, and they were considerable, to try and block a feminist movement. You know, some number of women associate their ideas and their future with patriarchy. But that's true of any group. You know, no group is 100% in line with a particular ideology or perspective. But it was, I think, for all of us a little sad to see that particular performance by Susan Collins. But we should also remember, as you did, it was Mitch McConnell and Donald Trump who drove that train. It was men. And not only men, your introduction was important. We're not just talking about an analysis of the sex gender system in patriarchy. We're talking about analysis of race and white supremacy. We're talking about an analysis of economic inequality and capitalism. I think a lot of people, when Brent Kavanaugh made his what seemed almost like a self-parody of a performance in front of the Senate committee, a performance that was so easy to parody that when Matt Damon did it on Saturday Night Live, it didn't even seem like that much of a stretch. That was not just Brent Kavanaugh. That was a very privileged white male who's part of the economic elite in a capitalist society. It was white supremacy, patriarchy, and capitalism on display. It was the way those things work together. And when people in that position are challenged, I think you often see they don't react well. There's a sense of entitlement. You could call it a right to rule that people like Brett Kavanaugh are raised with. Now, obviously not all men who might embrace Kavanaugh are other rich white men. But again, there's a kind of aspirational quality to masculinity than for people who aren't rich. You can see working class men, non-white men, who also want to be in that same position and might rally around Kavanaugh. That aggrieved entitlement is another phrase one hears, a sense that I have a right to this, and these challenges that might come from women or non-white people or from the labor unions, these challenges to my right to that position produce a kind of almost hysterical anxiety. And that's a good word for the way Kavanaugh reacted. You know, women are used to be calling used to be called hysterical if they are angry over injustice. But it really was Kavanaugh who was hysterical over this threat to his entitlement.
And again, I'm speaking with Robert Jensen, a professor in the School of Journalism at the University of Texas at Austin and a board member of the Third Coast Activist Resource Center in Austin. He's the author of Plain Radical, Living, Loving, and Learning to Leave the Planet Gracefully, Arguing for Our Lives, A User's Guide to Constructive Dialogue. And his latest book is The End of Patriarchy, Radical Feminism for Men. But on the Democratic side, the two men who blew it were Chuck Schumer, the Senate Minority Leader, and Michael Avenatti, the ambulance-chasing lawyer. They really were gifts to the Republicans. I mean, I really do rue the day that Harry Reid left the Senate. And, of course, in the vote, the other candidate who could have been the Minority Leader, Dick Durbin, who's so much better than Schumer. So.
I can't speak to political strategy in Washington. I don't pretend to know how to play that game. But I think you're right that Chuck Schumer seems just perfect for leading a Democratic Party that has no courage and no strategy. The failure seems pretty complete. Avenatti's another interesting character, though, and one I think worth some reflection. You know, a lot of people are holding him out as kind of a champion for the challenge to Trump, but Michael Avenatti is in some ways just the flip side of the Donald Trump coin. He's arrogant, he's you know, kind of a macho posturing bully type. So to watch Avenatti and Trump square off gives me a kind of sick feeling in the pit of my stomach. I'm certainly not on the Trump team, both in terms of, you know, party, in terms of voting, in terms of policy, in terms of anything. But I certainly don't also want to be on Avenatti's team. I don't think that's a way to build a progressive politics. It's both are very good at using media. Both are very good at playing the culture, in a sense. But both come out of that same sense of power as something one grabs, asserts, controls. Certainly not the idea of power as something one builds through engagement and collaboration. So Avenatti's contribution, and I use that in quotes, to the Kavanaugh hearings, of course, has been analyzed. Even people on the Democratic side wish he'd never shown up because the way he played the media and played the client he represented didn't add to the challenge. It detracted from the challenge to Kavanaugh. So that a very serious claim about Kavanaugh's behavior, and not only going back to when he was a teenager, but a critique of his behavior up until today, was easily undercut by people who saw Avenatti as, you know, throwing in a wild claim that was more difficult to substantiate.
Well, he didn't substantiate it.
Yeah.
So, but so we know, Robert, that the majority of men in this country vote Republican, and the majority of women in this country vote Democrat. How much do you think the needle is being moved in any direction here?
Well, you know, this has been the subject of a lot of commentary and analysis the last few days, and I don't pretend to have any particular insight into it. I think on the question of race, the tea leaves are a lot easier to read. Of course, the vast majority of non-white people in this country, especially black and brown, vote Democratic, and that's not going to change at all. The gender question is harder to understand. Will this produce a kind of outpouring of support for the Democrats because people are angry at how badly Blasey Ford and, by extension, women were treated in this? Or will it rally the Republican base? You know, polling seems to say both things are happening. I don't know. But it seems to me the Democratic Party, if it's going to be a useful vehicle for progressive change, in addition to all the other organizations and activities that try to do this, has got to provide a coherent project with coherent leadership. And as you pointed out, people like Chuck Schumer aren't exactly offering that. The wave of progressive successes, by no means, you know, an overwhelming trend that's going to change the Democrats overnight, but they do give some hope that younger people, people with more progressive values, disproportionately more women and people of color than the Democratic Party has typically put up, that that can be a source. But, you know, as many point out, sometimes it's not all that useful to try and predict. These are things we try to do something about and affect. I certainly don't have any predictions.
So how do women, and I mentioned that, you know, Mitch McConnell is sort of marginalizing all those protesters as a mob. And of course, the day after Trump's inauguration, there was a spontaneous manifestation of millions of women across the country and around the world showing up to protest. But in terms of a sustained protest and a strategy, how do you attack misogyny? I mean, you've got the poster boy for misogyny as the president of the United States. He's made it clear what he thinks about women in that Access Hollywood tape. It's, you know, and that didn't sink him for some reason or other. And there's still women who voted for him. So I don't know what the answer is here in terms of, I mean, do women have to resort to Lisa Strider and basically, you know, refuse to have sex with men until they get their act together?
Well, here I think we can observe a couple of things. One is, as many people point out, that if there's a change in electoral politics, it's not going to be just through a critique of patriarchy or just through a critique of white supremacy, just through a critique of capitalism. There has to be a coherent, holistic, unified base for an attempt to grab power through elections. And again, I don't consider myself much of a strategist in those arenas. It's hard work, and we can identify the goal without always being sure of the strategy to go forward. But, you know, I think back to the feminist movement, what's often called the second wave of feminism that came out of the 1960s, all that social ferment of the 60s produced many movements, including feminism. Well, first of all, we should recognize that there have been vast improvements in society because of that. As I often reminded younger students when I was teaching at the University of Texas, that rape crisis centers, domestic violence shelters didn't exist when I was a kid. The concept of date rape, the idea that a woman could be raped by an acquaintance, didn't exist when I was a kid. That all of these are the work of a feminist movement, and that I think the radical nature of the movement that produced those needs to be recaptured. Now, there's a lot of splits in the feminist movement as well, just like in any movement. I work on one of the issues that has been probably the most central split. I come out of a radical feminist critique of the way men routinely buy and sell women's bodies in pornography and prostitution. Not a critique of the women in those industries, but a critique of the industries and the way men exploit women. Well, I think the radical feminist critique is got a lot to offer, and I think reviving a lot of that is important. I think, as has been pointed out many times, in the defense of women's reproductive rights, which is often just a code word, let's face it, for abortion rights, that it's wealthy women who have still the most access to abortion, that poor and working class women often are cut off. And how do we restore not only the full right to abortion, but a meaningful right that is one that people can access? All of these things are part of building a movement. So, you know, we talk about the Me Too movement, and like everybody, I've been impressed by the efforts under that banner. But it's not a movement in the traditional sense. You need a feminist movement that looks across the board at all these issues and isn't afraid to get radical. And I think we see that on the question of challenging white supremacy, the question of challenging capitalism as well. Mere liberal attempts to modify an existing system increasingly don't do the job. And so how do we get back that spirit? But, of course, we're trying to get back that radical spirit at a time when there's a rising right-wing reactionary, some might even say neo-fascist force. So, again, I don't want to pretend there's some obvious solution I'm going to take off the shelf in some nice three-ring notebook and present to people. But I think we do need to think about these things. How does power operate? How do, in this case, men routinely control women? Why do women sometimes find themselves with very few choices and embrace that kind of patriarchal world? You know, here I would go back to some classic work. Andrea Dworkin, a feminist writer now more than a decade gone, interesting book called Right-Wing Women, where she asks that question. Why do women sometimes embrace right-wing politics? And she said it's not because those women are stupid, uninformed, or don't understand their own interests. They've made a choice that their own interests can be furthered that way, and Andrea's argument was, we can understand that, but it's a bad choice, and we need to make arguments that there are better choices for women.
Well, speaking of right-wing women, Kellyanne Conway of the White House recently said that she, too, was sexually assaulted. And a lot of women have come forth, and I don't know what the percentage is, but it's an enormous number of women have experienced some form of sexual assault, if not sexual molestation. And, you know, so how do you turn that movement of victimhood, because the word victim is always used, into victory?
Well, that's a good question. You know, Andrea Dworkin, a real touchstone for me in my education, when noting the shift from victim to survivor, where we talk less about sexual violence victims, more about sexual violence survivors, Andrea, of course, understood the reason, but she said, you know, victim is an important word. It describes a relationship to power. When you are the victim of a crime, you have been a victim, and it doesn't mean you're a victim in your essential nature. It doesn't mean you were born to be a victim. It means that that's the nature of the system in which you live, and it's important to challenge that. You know, Andrea argued that right-wing women know that they're at risk for violence, know that men's violence against women and children is a serious problem, and they make the bet that if they ally themselves with male power, they'll be protected. And, of course, what we know about the reality of domestic violence and sexual violence is you are not, if you're a woman, safe when you're with your men, that is, family, for instance, husbands, fathers, and that. That's, in fact, often when you're at greatest risk. So Andrea's argument was not, I don't understand what might motivate women to try and, in a sense, cut a deal with patriarchy. She said, it's a bad deal. It doesn't protect you in the way that you think it will. And to challenge that, of course, there needs to be a vibrant feminist movement. And, of course, the backlash, and that's another important word to bring back, the 1991 book by Susan Faludi, that when women do make gains, we pointed out that, you know, rape crisis centers, domestic violence shelters were gains that women made in the 1970s and 80s. Well, there was a pushback to that, and Faludi pointed that out quite clearly, that when those feminist gains are made, there's a reaction. That's, for those who are too young to remember, that's the era when people like Rush Limbaugh started coining the term feminazi to, again, suggest that somehow women asserting their rights were an attack on men. You know, we need to remember that this playbook that Trump and Kavanaugh worked from is not new. It feels a lot like just a recycling of that old late 80s, early 90s attack on feminism that Faludi describes.
Well, Robert Jensen, I'm afraid we've run out of time, but I appreciate you joining us, and I thank you.
All right. Thanks, Ian.
And again, I've been speaking with Robert Jensen. He's a professor in the School of Journalism at the University of Texas at Austin and a board member of the Third Coast Activist Resource Center in Austin. He's the author of Plain Radical, Living, Loving, and Learning to Leave the Planet Gracefully, Arguing for Our Lives, A User's Guide to Constructive Dialogue. And his latest book is The End of Patriarchy, Radical Feminism for Men. We're going to take a brief station break and back examining the elections underway in Brazil.
You're nothing but a dirty, dirty old man. You do your thinking with a one-track mind. Talking about heaven, glory, but on your face is a different story. Clean up your rap, your story's getting dusty. Wash out your mouth, your lies are getting rusty. Can't believe nothing you say, 'cause I'm around and I see what you do. You know you're... Pensando assim, procurando por ela, e me peguei sonhando em vão, me destroçando o coração. Não sabia de mim, não sabia.
Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing, available 24/7 at backgroundbriefing.org. And joining us now is Mary Luisa Mendonça, the director of Brazil's Network for Social Justice and Human Rights, as well as a professor in the International Relations Department at the University of Rio de Janeiro. Welcome to Background Briefing, Mary Louise Mendoza.
Thank you very much.
And do we have any updates, or do you have? I know you've been following the elections underway today in Brazil. Obviously, it's a very critical election between a very polarized left and right, with a candidate on the right who's supposed to be the front runner, who is as close to a kind of fascist as you get in politics today, at least in democratic politics. Small d democratic. Jair Bolsonaro has to get 50% outright to avoid a runoff. So let's start with that question. Do you expect there to be a runoff election in 3 weeks' time?
Yes, I think so. I don't think he has 50% of the votes. The reason, actually, that he's the front runner is because Luiz Inácio Lula da Silva, the former president, is in jail. And there was a parliamentary coup against former president Dilma Rousseff. So we cannot say that this is a normal election and Brazil is a democracy, because the impeachment against Dilma Rousseff was a coup because, you know, she didn't commit any crime. The parliament accused her of a very common practice, accounting practice in the federal budget. So it was a way for right-wing forces to take power in Brazil because they have not been able to win elections for over a decade. So because of this vacuum that, you know, Lula was the most popular politician, still is, even though he's in jail also, with no evidence of crime. He was put in jail also, you know, because they want the right-wing forces in Brazil couldn't allow him to run. So he is accused of receiving an apartment as a bribe, but the apartment is not in his name. He never used the apartment in any way. There is no evidence that, you know, he received any bribes. So this is not, you know, we cannot say that Brazil is a democracy now. So the fascist forces now, and the reason why Bolsonaro is popular is because, you know, since the coup against Dilma Rousseff, the democracy in Brazil is being undermined. So what we hope is that the candidate that was supported by Lula, Fernando Haddad, will get almost 30% of the votes, and, you know, together with the other candidates, then they will make over 50% of the votes, and then we're going to have a second round of elections in 3 weeks.
But has this political turmoil, does it contribute to a recent poll in Brazil that indicated about one-third of the country no longer believes in democracy?
Yes, of course. What happens is that since the coup, in order to justify the coup against President Dilma Rousseff, the right-wing forces in all mainstream media started to build this idea that all politicians are corrupt, that we cannot trust anybody. So that led people to a situation of, you know, nothing, you know, it doesn't matter what anything that we do. So, and of course, that type of context is the right context if you want to build fascism, right? You create fear, you create a sense of that is no reason to vote, you know, that, you know, you undermine democracy. So the cynicism, the lack of hope, all of this led to this situation. Also, because the main reason for the coup was to implement neoliberal policies, far right conservative policies that caused recession. and a very deep economic crisis. Mm. So cuts in social programs, in education, in healthcare, you know, all types of investments.
Right. Well, we certainly know that from the tragedy of the fire at Brazil's National Museum.
Exactly.
You know, that is a metaphor for everything you're saying, Maria Luisa.
Exactly. Yes.
Again, I'm speaking with Maria Luisa Mendonça, who's a director of Brazil's Network for Social Justice and Human Rights, as well as a professor in the International Relations Department at the University of Rio de Janeiro. So, nevertheless, there is a severe crime problem, is there not, in Brazil? And that, of course, is what Bolsonaro is seizing on. He's even talking about... you know, he's almost talking like a member of the NRA here in the United States, where he wants Brazilians to start arming themselves. And, of course, the most outrageous things he's said is he said an opposition female candidate was not worth raping and that he would prefer a dead son to a gay son. He's walking back all of that rhetoric, but isn't his main platform the idea of – and, by the way, this is typical of all fascist leaders. They always come in like Mussolini and Hitler and the guy in Turkey, Erdogan, who's, I think, very similar to this character in Brazil, is the idea that they're going to bring about law and order and stop the crime in the streets, you know. So is there an appeal to that, for that in the country?
Yes, I mean, it's really difficult for us to understand how people can vote for someone like this, right, who defends torture, who says that, you know, women are not even, you know, that talks about rape and torture openly. So, the idea of that we need more guns on the streets and all of that also has to do with the economic crisis. During the administration of President Lula and President Dilma Rousseff, unemployment rate was very low, was 4%. So we had a situation of almost full employment. There was a lot of investment in education. So people, young people, had a perspective of, you know, studying and finding a job. And of course, now the unemployment rate is 15%. So, you know, that is a great inflation in the country. So, for example, the price of gasoline was 2 and now it's 5 reais, which is the Brazilian currency. So, you know, that of course leads to more violence, more crime. And then, you know, that is, so instead of bringing back, you know, the main root causes of the problem and understanding the social economic problems, then, you know, he appeals to fear. So, and of course, mainstream media in Brazil play a big role because in Brazil, all, for example, all the TV stations are far right wing. It's almost like you only had Fox News here in the U.S. So there is a lot of media manipulation and also a lot of fake news being spread on social media. Steve Bannon actually is one of the advisors for Jair Bolsonaro. So they spread a lot of fake news over, you know, Twitter and Facebook and WhatsApp. So there is a lot of misinformation and a very direct campaign of fear, and people, you know, just get trapped into this situation.
Well, just in the last couple of minutes, if Jair Bolsonaro and Haddad on the other side get, you know, 30+% of the vote, and neither, they'll probably both come out pretty even, I would imagine. What is the story with all the other parties in terms of a runoff? What's likely to happen? Yeah. Will the other parties support one or the other?
Yes, I mean, we have two left-wing candidates that together have about 15% of the votes, probably. So Haddad has a good chance of winning if the right wing, you know, if things continue in a regular way, right? Our fear is that Jair Bolsonaro already said that he would not accept the result of the election if he doesn't win. So it's very similar to Trump in that way. So we need to defend democracy in Brazil. It's a very dangerous moment because, yeah, you know, we are dealing with a radical fascist candidate. That could be a disaster, not just for Brazil, but for the whole region. So we need to pay attention and monitor the situation. Also, a big question would be what will happen with the conservative parties that are more moderate, like, you know, the neoliberal parties that, you know, defend, for example, structural adjustment reforms, but cannot defend fascism openly. This is a big question. So we don't know what's going to happen with that. But hopefully the progressive forces, you know, will be able to win and just prevent this huge disaster, which would be, you know, electing a fascist person in Brazil.
But just in the last minute, that would that mean an unlikely union of the left and the Conservative Party?
Well, the big question is what the conservative parties would do. We don't know. They haven't announced. Mm-hmm. For sure, you know, I think we have enough votes among the progressive parties to win. But, you know, the fear is that, you know, there could be something unusual happening between now and then because we are not, this is not a regular elections. We are not in a regular democracy in Brazil. So hopefully the liberal, you know, the neoliberal conservative forces in Brazil would not seek this, you know, very risky path that, you know, to support a fascist candidate. So hopefully, you know, at the end, we will have, we will be back as, you know, as a democratic country, which we are not at this point.
Well, Maria Luisa Mendonça, I thank you very much for joining us here today.
Thank you very much.
And again, I've been speaking with Maria Luisa Mendonça, who is the director of Brazil's Network for Social Justice and Human Rights, as well as a professor in the International Relations Department at the University of Rio de Janeiro. And we're going to take a brief station break, and with a month to go before the critical midterm elections, we'll analyze the state of voting in the country following the record low turnout in the last 2014 midterms, in which only 140 million Americans voted, the lowest turnout since 1942, followed by just over 25% of American adults voting Donald Trump into the presidency in 2016.
Just are you don't
Welcome back. I'm Ian Masterson. This is Background Briefing, available 24/7 at backgroundbriefing.org. And joining us now is Alan Lichtman, who is an American political historian who teaches at American University and has studied both the American right and the presidency. His books include White Protestant Nation, The Rise of the American Conservative Movement, and The Keys to the White House, A Surefire Way to Predicting the Next President. His prediction system has correctly predicted the outcomes of all U.S. presidential elections since 1984, including the last election when, against all odds, he predicted a Trump victory. The author of the national bestseller, The Case for Impeachment, his latest book just out is The Embattled Vote in America, From the Founding to the Present. Welcome to Background Briefing, Alan Lichtman.
Thank you so much.
So, Alan, your new book, of course, The Embattled Vote in America, From the Founding to the Present, is very timely, shall we say, because we've got about a month before this critical midterm election. There's a lot of concern, for example, that Russia could interfere in this election as they did in 2016. They helped Trump out once before. It's not inconceivable that Putin and Trump made a deal in that secret meeting they had in Helsinki. But if we can put that aside, we still got enormous amount of voter suppression going on. And in general, the thing that's really alarming is how few people voted in 2014. I mean, it's just shocking when you look at the statistics. So in spite of all this talk about a blue wave, what's your sense of what kind of turnout we're going to get? Let me just point out that in 2014, 140 million people did not vote. It's the lowest turnout since 1942. And in 2016, just 25% of American adults voted for Donald Trump.
You know, Paul Weyrich, one of the founders of the modern conservative movement, in the 1980s, made a very famous speech in which he said, "I don't believe in this goo-goo government movement for high turnout, for letting people have the opportunity to vote." Quite the opposite. Conservatives and Republicans benefit from low turnout. And in candid moments recently, other Republicans have echoed that same sentiment. And in particular, they believe that they benefit from low turnout by women, racial minorities, and young people. And in recent years, we have seen a surge of measures designed to restrict voting opportunities for those who are part of the demographic base. Things like stringent voter ID laws designed to deter non-existent voter impersonation at the polls, drastic purging of voter registration rolls. Of course, continued, in many states, restriction of voting by former felons, limitations on opportunities to register and vote early. And many of these elections in the upcoming midterm, just a month from now, are going to be extremely close and could be decided by a very few votes. And these measures of voter suppression could well turn the tide for Republicans in what is supposed to be a blue wave. So anyone who is dismayed by the would-be autocrat that is our president, by the tactics of the Republican Party to divide us, to weaken America as a democracy, the only answer is to get out and vote. Midterm elections are a turnout game. Turnout is everything. And if you don't turn out to vote, then you have no one but yourself to blame.
Well, President Trump, of course, had a rally in Kansas on behalf of Kris Kobach, who headed up his bogus election investigation. They couldn't find anything wrong. But again, both Kobach was Secretary of State, now running for governor, and is Secretary of State and is running for governor. And the same is happening in Georgia. You have a Secretary of State running for governor. The Georgia governor, we know he rigged the vote against John Ossoff in that important by-election that took place where everybody was watching shortly after Trump. It was the first key by-election. because they have an electronic voting system down there, he was able to rig the vote so that Ossoff didn't get past the 50% needed. So he had to have a runoff, and the Republicans were able to defeat him. That's just a fact. So this is extraordinary. Endorsing Kobach is like putting Dracula in charge of the blood bank.
That's absolutely right. Look, this bogus idea of voter fraud is as old as the Republic and has been used time and time again to disenfranchise Americans. The bogus cry of voter fraud was used in the early Republic to disenfranchise women and to disenfranchise racial minorities. The argument was made that we can't let women vote because their vote will be bought and corrupted, because women are weak and dependent. We can't let African Americans vote because African Americans are ignorant and immoral, and their vote will be bought and corrupted. So this phony cry of voter fraud is simply the thinnest of pretexts for voter suppression. Today, we hear the cry, the same cry of voter fraud. Donald Trump claims 3 to 5 million illegal voters somehow mysteriously appeared on Election Day. All voted for Hillary Clinton and mysteriously disappeared. It's the biggest bogus claim in American history since Donald Trump's claim that Barack Obama was born outside the United States. Kris Kobach, a Secretary of State of Kansas, several years ago said, we have so many thousands of illegal voters in Kansas. You've got to give me authority, the only one in the country as Secretary of State, to investigate and prosecute voter fraud. You know how many prosecutions he's come up with? 12. And almost all of them are Republicans who voted in two states because they thought they could vote in states where they had property. And we know Kris Kobach's, as you pointed out, this bogus fraud commission was dissolved because it couldn't come up with any substantial voter fraud. In the states of North Carolina, Wisconsin, and Pennsylvania, when they were in court defending their voter stringent photo ID laws between the three states, in the entire modern history of the states, they come up with exactly two examples of voter impersonation at the polls. The fraud is the fraud being pulled on the American people that we need to restrict and suppress the vote to deal with what is essentially non-existent voter fraud in America.
And again, I'm speaking with Alan Lichtman, who's an American political historian who teaches at American University and has studied both the American right and the presidency. His books include White Protestant Nation, The Rise of the American Conservative Movement, and The Keys to the White House, A Surefire Way to Predicting the Next President. His prediction system has correctly predicted the outcomes of all U.S. presidential elections since 1984, including the last election when, against all odds, he predicted a Trump victory. The author of the national bestseller, The Case for Impeachment. His latest book, just out, is The Embattled Vote in America, From the Founding to the Present. Can you make the case that if you are against voting and against full enfranchisement, and that you really don't believe that your fellow citizens should be able to vote, isn't that also de facto admission that you don't believe in democracy, that you're, I mean, isn't that on the path to kind of authoritarianism or fascism?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, Donald Trump has made it crystal clear that he doesn't believe in democracy. Look at the leaders he has embraced around the world. The most autocratic, least democratic, most bloodthirsty leaders who have killed, imprisoned their own people, Duterte in the Philippines, Putin in Russia, and of course Kim Jong-un, his love partner in North Korea. Look at his attack on the free press. You know, if you go back to the framers, they were powerful supporters of the free press as essential to democracy. Indeed, we now have a president who doesn't believe in democracy, who only believes in winning and expanding his own power and enriching himself and is certainly willing to take whatever steps necessary to suppress democracy in America. You know, voter turnout already in America, we're supposed to be the beacon of democracy for the world. We stand near the bottom of peer nations in voter turnout. And the last thing we need is to continue these methods of voter suppression that are only going to restrict voter turnout even more and play right into the hands of those who believe in power and not democracy.
Well, I think that's the idea, isn't it? Power as opposed to democracy. And that's pretty clear. We saw actually an exercise in power in the Senate as they pushed through the nomination of and confirmed Judge Kavanaugh. I mean, one of the most frightening statistics is that by the year 2040, because of the demographic shifts underway in this country where people are moving into cities and particularly in blue states, that by the year 2040, the Republicans from the red states will have 70 Senate seats and the Democrats will only have 30. And that's, of course, a lot to do with the Electoral College, which you, in your book, Alan Lichtman, talk about getting rid of. So as long as the Republicans control the Senate, they will control the courts. And we've just seen that happen.
That's exactly right. And here's what's really going on. And this is what really frightens me. And, you know, as I point out in the embattled vote, the restriction of the vote is all part of this. The right wing in America has already wiped out income equality. We now have an inequality of income in America equal to that on the eve of the Great Depression of 1929. All the gains of the New Deal years and subsequently have been wiped out. We are now a nation of the rich and everybody else. Now the right wing is going after gender equality and racial equality. Those are their next two targets. And essential to that, as I point out in the embattled vote in America, is voter suppression. And as you point out, also essential to that is control of the courts. You know, Susan Collins, the critical swing vote, has got to be the biggest hypocrite in America or the biggest sucker in America, and I believe both. This is the only thing anyone will ever remember her for. And, you know, she claims to be a supporter of gender equality. Well, when this court strikes a huge blow against gender equality by restricting women's access to safe and legal abortion, by restricting women's ability to gain redress from sexual harassment and employment discrimination, that will be laid at the feet of Susan Collins, the enabler of those other more brazen Republicans.
And that could happen soon. Roe v. Wade could be overturned very soon.
And it doesn't have to be overturned.
No.
This is what people don't understand. You don't have to explicitly overturn Roe versus Wade. You just have to accept within the confines of Roe versus Wade so many restrictions as to make it null and void.
And all those are already done at the state level, right? So that's
correct. And they're now going to be rubber stamped by the Supreme Court.
Right. So let's talk about I brought up the Electoral College. Let's talk about some of the fixes that you have in your book, The Embattled Vote in America, from the founding to the present. Going back to the founding, my understanding is that the reason that the states control voting as opposed to the feds, which is what you advocate and what makes sense and what every other democracy has. Every other democracy only has one vote, first past the post. We have two, first past the post, and then this extra Electoral College thing that gave us Donald Trump and will continue to give us minority presidents. So let's start with that. Was that the deal breaker? In other words, in order to get the 13 states to join the union, the founding fathers had to compromise and allow them to vote. Was that their initial demand?
On the Electoral College?
No, back to the beginning. In other words, why do the states control voting. I thought that was the demand of the first 13 colonies. They said, we're not going to join the Union unless we control our own voting.
Well, that's only part of it. Yes, the framers of the Constitution were very wary of putting voting qualifications in the Constitution because they were indeed afraid that if they took that power away from the states, that it wouldn't be ratified. That's absolutely correct. The other issue, and they spent very little time, remarkably, at the Philadelphia Convention on voting, was that they all believed in restrictive voting. They believe voting should be limited to those who own property or minimal paid taxes, those who had a so-called stake in society, but they could not agree on how to specify economic qualifications within the Constitution, and that also led to the default to the states and the lack of any guarantee of the right to vote in our Constitution, which is perpetuated to this day.
Well, that's the extraordinary thing. The Founding Fathers had it both ways. They wanted to have, you know, all men are created equal and all that lofty language. But at the same time, they made sure that only white men of property voted. And, of course, George Mason, who was the mentor, if you will, of both Jefferson and Washington, he had the biggest library in the Americas, quite an intellectual, and a very man of great conscience. He refused to sign the Constitution because he felt they were trying to finesse race and slavery, and that it would eventually come back to bite them, as it did with the Civil War.
Certainly. And by the way, the Electoral College is intimately tied to slavery. If, in fact, you have the popular vote deciding the president, then states like Virginia would lose hundreds of thousands of votes because slaves couldn't vote. They'd lose political power. But under the Electoral College and the notorious three-fifths compromise, the slaves were counted as three-fifths of a person for apportioning both the House of Representatives and the Electoral College. So even though in Virginia slaves were property and had no rights and couldn't vote, they still helped Virginia by counting at a three-fifths ratio for their representation in Congress and in the Electoral College. So the Electoral College system is deeply tainted with slavery.
Well, Alan Lichtman, I thank you so much for joining us here today.
My great pleasure, Ian. Take care.
Thank you. And I've been speaking with Alan Lichtman, who's an American political historian who teaches at American University and has studied both the American right and the presidency. His books include White Protestant Nation, The Rise of the American Conservative Movement, and The Keys to the White House, A Surefire Way to Predicting the Next President. His prediction system has correctly predicted the outcome of all U.S. presidential elections since 1984, including the last election, when against all odds, he predicted a Trump victory. The author of the national bestseller, The Case for Impeachment, his latest book just out is The Embattled Vote in America, From the Founding to the Present. This has been Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters. I'd like to thank producer Graham Fitzgibbon. This program's available for podcasting at backgroundbriefing.org. We can also contact me, and I'll be back again tomorrow with another Background Briefing. Bye for now.